This had to occur. I'm glad that it's happening now rather than 5 or more years ago.
Alaska continues preparations as the new flu virus shows up in Washington state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 30th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young falls victim to a Twitter imposter.
It doesn't say anywhere there that it's a joke site or it's for fun. And that's the problem.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Alaska's closest U.S. neighbor has at least 13 probable cases of H1N1 swine flu. Washington state health officials identified the first cases in the state late yesterday and announced 5 more infections this afternoon. The Seattle Times is reporting one sick city resident is a doctor who saw more than a dozen patients when she had early symptoms that she assumed were due to allergies. Cases have also been discovered in Idaho and Oregon, but Alaska has remained clear so far. Dr. Jay Butler is the state's chief medical officer. He says the infections in the Northwest are not a surprise.
If I had to predict a prediction of the viral spread, it would probably be along the airline routes. And so moving from the Southwest and the South into the Northwest and eventually on to Alaska is pretty much, I think, what we would anticipate.
So if we expect swine flu to arrive in Alaska, based on how the outbreak is developing, do you have a sense of how soon that would happen?
I don't have a crystal ball to say when, but I think certainly we would not be saying if.
How is this flu different or more dangerous than others?
It's really too early to say how bad this virus will be. I know there's a lot of talk about maybe it's no worse than seasonal influenza, but there's barely 100 cases of a disease that a week ago we didn't even know existed. So it's still pretty early on. I would not be comfortable saying that it's no worse than seasonal influenza quite yet. The other thing to keep in mind is on average, 36,000 people die of seasonal influenza each year. So even if it's similar to seasonal influenza, that's an additional 36,000 deaths. So it's not an insignificant factor, even if it is like seasonal influenza.
Have we had any suspected cases in Alaska yet?
We've had cases of ongoing influenza, and that really has nothing to do with the current outbreak. We are in the flu season still in Alaska, so there's been people with flu-like illness, specimens going to the lab all along. The number of submissions of specimens has increased, in part because people are concerned about the outbreak of the 2009 H1N1 virus. However, so far, all of the viruses that have been isolated in the lab have been confirmed to be seasonal influenza. So at this time, we have not confirmed that the virus has arrived in Alaska.
And Dr. Butler, what is the state doing to prepare for swine flu?
Well, the focus has been working with the community partners because all emergency response is at the local level. We've been working on making sure that antiviral drugs are available, although it may well be that this particular outbreak, antiviral drugs will not have a major role. If indeed it turns out that this infection is relatively mild, antiviral drugs may not be used very much. But we want those to be out in community. So those shipments are beginning to occur. We're also receiving antiviral drugs as well as masks and some medical supplies from the Strategic National Stockpile. And those supplies will be arriving in Alaska within about 24 hours.
And how prepared or are healthcare providers ready to handle an outbreak?
Well, preparedness is always one of those, it's not an all or none. And I think I can say that because of the concern about bird flu, we are much more prepared than we were 5 years ago. So if this had to occur, I'm glad that it's happening now rather than five or more years ago. I'd also like to point out for us in Alaska, we now have a state-of-the-art virology lab that is just opening now. The grand opening hasn't even happened yet, but that's a wonderful resource. And we will be able to confirm cases of infection with the new virus within a few days in-state in Alaska.
Are there any unique characteristics of Alaska that may make it easier or more difficult to deal with the infection here?
Well, the most unique characteristic of Alaska is our small population spread out over a very large area, with some major exceptions, particularly in the municipality of Anchorage. That may very well help slow spread, the fact that we're so spread out, but it also makes it a little more difficult to be able to get supplies out if indeed there's a local demand for medical supplies.
Dr. Jay Butler is the chief medical officer in Alaska. The swine flu scare may divert some travelers to Alaska. That's according to industry expert Mike Driscoll, who runs the publication Cruise Week. He talks to travel agents on a regular basis, and he says some are rebooking Mexico-bound tourists onto Alaska cruise ships. Driscoll says that could help an industry hit hard by the economic downturn.
That might just be a two-week blip. But it might be something longer. And if it's something longer, I think that would really help Alaska, because the nature of the whole situation, Alaska being a U.S. state, is viewed as being healthy, so comparatively. So it's rather appealing right now.
Alaska cruises might seem an unexpected replacement for trips south of the border, but Driscoll says they're similar in price and duration. Cruise lines have been reluctant to discuss the flu's possible impacts, but Driscoll says they're ready for onboard outbreaks if they happen.
There's 3,000 people in an enclosed environment. It's not an ideal situation, but they're very aware of how to handle flu situations. The staff is well trained in terms of, you know, keeping people quarantined in their cabins.
Cruise lines developed protocols for screening passengers and sanitizing ships after outbreaks of Norwalk-type viruses. Officials say those would easily apply to the swine flu. Alaska Travel Industry Association President Ron Peck says others have followed suit.
Some hotels have got some pretty specific mediation processes in terms of what kind of steps they need to take to clean up rooms where there may have been issues or concerns. And same with a lot of the motor coach operators have the same kind of thing. If they've identified someone who has been ill, they clean the motor coach out, sterilize it, and sanitize it also.
The association has sent a flu information bulletin to its 1,100 members that includes basics such as hand washing and letting visitors know that Alaska has up-to-date medical facilities. About 1 million cruise ship passengers are expected this summer. Another 700,000 or so other travelers will visit Alaska via plane, car, or RV. Alaska Congressman Don Young is the victim of an internet imposter. Someone posing as him set up a profile on the social networking site Twitter, where people can write tweets or short statements about what they're doing or thinking about. The imposter had comments ranging from talking about playing video games to making a bogus claim that a fellow Republican was planning to introduce articles of impeachment against President Obama. Twitter yanked the account this afternoon, but archived versions are still searchable online. Young's spokeswoman Meredith Kenny says her office contacted Twitter as soon as they discovered the account so it could be removed.
There's nothing on there anywhere that tells people that they're not actually speaking to Congressman Young. And if you look at replies that people have posted, and of the 1,400 followers, they all mostly believe that they are speaking of Congressman Young, which is fraud. It's misleading to folks. It doesn't say anywhere there that it's a joke site or it's for fun. And that's a problem.
The bogus Young site included his official congressional photograph. Kenny says her office found out about the account yesterday when a congressional website called asking to verify it was his. Kenny says what's especially troublesome about the fake Young site is that the imposter linked to other House members' pages.
We've had to make it clear to other members that the congressman is not posting these messages to them, as well as to other media outlets.
Kenny says Young's office is now taking over a variety of sites bearing his name, so they have control over them.
I don't know if we'll do a Twitter site or not. I don't know if the congressman is ready for that kind of technology yet, but we are, you know, looking at something towards the future. It's possible in the future. This might get us going on it, actually.
A growing number of Congress members are using Twitter. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski has a site, and while Senator Mark Begich does not, his office says he may eventually set one up. There are dozens of sites that use Governor Sarah Palin's name, started by her supporters and detractors. The fake Young profile launched on Monday and already had 1,400 followers, including what looked like Newt Gingrich and a site representing President Obama. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Governor Palin restores retirement benefits to members of Alaska's Territorial Guard.
At least 27 women made up the Guard, and the ages of the Guard members range from 80 years old all the way down to 12 years old.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
The legislature quietly changed Alaska's Ocean Ranger program before it adjourned. The change avoided much of the controversy a similar attempt brought 2 years before. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Voters created the Ocean Rangers program in 2006 when they passed a citizens' initiative to regulate and tax cruise ships. It funded about 30 trained environmental monitors who were placed aboard the ships. Their job is to keep an eye on wastewater, air quality, food safety, and other possible problem areas. Lawmakers in 2007 debated qualifications of the rangers themselves, but they ultimately left the language as is until this year. Lynn Kent is director of the State Division of Water.
Under the prior law, Ocean Rangers had to be a Coast Guard licensed marine engineer. And under this change, which is actually a pretty minor change in terms of wording, it allows the Ocean Rangers to also be either a marine engineer licensed by the United States Coast Guard or a person who holds a degree in marine safety and environmental protection or an equivalent course of study approved by the department from an accredited maritime educational institution.
The change was added to an air quality grant bill just a few days before lawmakers adjourned, and it passed without opposition or significant debate. It will take effect once it's signed by the governor. But backers of the original measure say it was no sleight of hand. Juneau attorney Joe Geldof is an author of the voter-approved Ranger Rules. He says he reviewed the change before it passed and determined it maintained the program's integrity.
This is a narrow, almost technical change that allows a few people who are living in Alaska who have gone to a maritime academy, have extensive background, but are not licensed marine engineers, but in all other regards are fully capable of serving as an ocean ranger to apply and possibly be part of the Ocean Ranger program to protect our waters.
The change does not include a residency requirement, which would not stand up in court. But backers say they hope it will make it easier for more Alaskans to work as onboard environmental monitors. Cruise ship program manager Denise Koch says only one of the state's 32 Ocean Rangers is a resident. Two more applicants meet the old qualifications, and the program is trying to recruit more people in-state. Koch says it's unclear whether the new law's broader qualifications will make a difference.
We know of one Alaskan who has a degree in marine safety and environmental protection. So there is that one extra person that could qualify. We're not sure yet how many other Alaskans will have this sort of degree.
In fact, officials say inquiries from that one person led to the legislative change. A report from last year's season shows rangers filed thousands of reports, and only a small number included problems on board the ships. Some of those involved petroleum products, wastewater, boilers, health and safety. None required enforcement actions. Still, Koch says their presence was needed.
I do think that the Ocean Rangers' presence still is a success because they can assure the Alaska public that nothing largely untoward or illegal is happening on board these ships.
The state spends about $4 million a year on the Ocean Rangers program. The money comes from a fee charged cruise ship passengers, and most of it goes to a contract with Crowley Marine Services, a Florida corporation that manages the Rangers program. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
During a teleconference Tuesday, the Alaska Board of Fisheries briefly considered and ultimately rejected an effort to move an already scheduled meeting to the Bristol Bay region from Anchorage. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting related to Bristol Bay will be held in Anchorage and is currently scheduled for December 1st through the 8th. In advance of Tuesday's teleconference, the board received hundreds of comments from area residents who wanted the meeting changed to a Bristol Bay location. Among those who commented was area drift fisherman Fritz Johnson.
The whole population of the region is like 7,500. That's like 30% of the population here has a direct interest in the commercial fishery. You try to do that calculation in an urban area, and it's not even on the radar. It's not a statistical blip. But 30% of the people here have a direct interest in fishing, and the decisions that the Fish Board makes affects their livelihood.
Johnson estimates that up to 350 Bristol Bay residents submitted comments or signed petitions that were sent to the board asking them to consider moving that December meeting. Jim Marcotte, the executive director of the Board of Fisheries, confirmed that the board decided to take no action on the idea of moving the meeting out of Anchorage.
The acting chair surveyed the interest level of the board members and found that there was not sufficient interest to bring the topic up.
Fritz Johnson, who listened in on Tuesday's teleconference, disagrees with Marcotte's assessment that there was no interest among board members to move the meeting.
Seemed to me there were four people who were interested in reconsidering the meeting location, and for some reason, their votes didn't count.
Apparently, the decision to take no action on the meeting relocation request was handled through an informal straw poll as opposed to a formal vote of the board. Marcotte stressed that the Board of Fisheries considers public comments and public input in advance of making their decisions.
They get that public input in a variety of ways. One is through written comments that people send in. So all of those are presented to the board, and the board members do indeed read through those and are informed by those. There's also a system of local fish and game advisory committees. It's a state-sponsored system, and the state pays for a representative from each of the advisory committees to attend board meetings where there are issues that are being addressed that affect the committees.
In the past, the Board of Fisheries has held public hearings in locations affected by proposals in advance of the full Board of Fisheries meeting. Fritz Johnson says that would be helpful, but will not solve the problem of allowing local residents to personally weigh in on proposals.
But I think it needs to be here. I think the Board of Fisheries needs to hear from and see the people whose lives that they're going to be affecting by their decisions, and they need to be able to look them in the eye when they take the vote.
The last Board of Fisheries meeting related to Bristol Bay was held in 2006, and that meeting was held in Dillingham. It attracted hundreds of local residents, many of whom would likely not be able to attend a meeting in Anchorage. Marcotte says the board makes it a priority to alternate meeting sites as opposed to holding every meeting in the region. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Senate Indian Affairs Committee gave their approval today to President Obama's nominee for the Director of Indian Health Services. Dr. Yvette Roubidoux now faces a confirmation vote before the entire Senate. The committee approved her by unanimous voice vote this morning. Committee member Senator Lisa Murkowski did not attend today's vote or Roubidoux's question and answer session last week. However, the senator's office says she does support her nomination. If confirmed, Dr. Roubidoux would be the first Native American woman to lead the IHS. She grew up in South Dakota and is a member of the Rosebud Sioux and Standing Rock Sioux tribes. Roubidoux holds degrees from Harvard and has worked as a physician and administrator within IHS. At last week's confirmation hearing, Roubidoux said one of her goals will be fighting diabetes.
It's a huge problem. It is causing so much of a burden on our population, and a huge part of the budget in the Indian Health Service is spent on the complications of diabetes. I think we can focus efforts in two areas, in both prevention and treatment.
Roubidoux said another crisis in Indian country is suicide, especially among teenagers.
I think that problems like suicide have deep roots throughout all of the issues we face in Indian country, and that it's important when we look at the solution for suicide that we work closely with our communities and we work with as many partners as we can to try to figure out how to adequately identify people at risk, how to treat them and respond to them and keep them safe, but we also have to definitely work on correcting those factors in our communities that are making our children think that they don't have a life that's worth living.
Rubidoux outlined four priorities to strengthen partnerships with tribes, reform IHS, improve quality and access to health care for Native Americans, and make IHS accountable and responsive to patients. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee gave her its full support, but warned she has a massive challenge ahead of her, Chairman Byron Dorgan of South Dakota.
I want to start by saying that I believe Dr. Rubidoux will be inheriting an Indian health system that is broken. The Indian Health Service is only funded at about one half of its need. Clinician shortages are rampant. Significant health disparities permeate Indian country. In addition, the Indian Health Service is an agency, I believe, with a history of some very serious management problems and very little follow-through, even when those problems are described.
The Indian Health Service has about 700 facilities and has a budget this year of more than $3.5 billion.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Governor Sarah Palin visited Haines Wednesday to sign a bill into law that will continue providing retirement benefits to Alaska Territorial Guard veterans. From KHNS, Tara Bicknell has more from Haines.
What we're going to do today is sign Senate Bill 89 and a resolution that really is celebrating the patriotism that I know that you all so embrace and the appreciation that we have for those who have served in our armed forces.
The Guard's pensions were recently reduced by the federal government due to a new interpretation by the U.S. Department of Defense. Haines Representative Bill Thomas spoke in favor of the bill during House discussions, saying, "I'm proud to help these Alaskan and American heroes get the recognition and financial support they deserve." The crowd applauded as Palin thanked the community and honored the veterans gathered at Sunny Lookout Point.
Mayor, thank you so much for the kind introduction, and thank you for hosting this very worthwhile event in your beautiful city, and it is so beautiful. And as I said, to our veterans who are represented here, our fine American Legion and their commander, Jim Murren, thank you for your service.
The Alaska Territorial Guard formed in 1942 out of necessity at a time when Japanese aircraft and submarine sightings were common. There are 26 remaining Territorial Guardsmen still living.
The Alaska Territorial Guard was our last line of defense during World War II, as the National Guard, usually posted in Alaska, were deployed elsewhere by the U.S. government. At that time, enemy planes and warships were trolling our waters and our airspace, and they were inciting a lot of fear in a lot of citizens. In a time of war, 6,389 Alaskans stepped forward willingly to protect their families and their neighbors, our land, our properties. Of that number, at least 27 women made up the Guard, and the ages of the Guard members ranged from 80 years old all the way down to 12 years old. The Alaska Territorial Guard engaged in combat with the enemy and protected the Lend-Lease route that stretched from North America to the Soviet Union. And by the way, you can see Russia from Alaska.
The bill was signed at noon at Lookout Point, and many representatives from the American Legion were present. Chilkat Valley preschool students performed the national anthem, and dozens of residents turned out to shake hands, hold signs, or just listen. Former Haines Mayor Mike Case was one spectator.
Oh, I'm just tickled that she was here. I think it's very good. Of course, on nice weather like this, everybody else was able to come out to see her too. And she's so accommodating to people. Signed jackets and hands and caps and papers and everything. So it was wonderful.
Reporting from member station KHNS, this is Tara Bicknell in Haines.
Computers and the internet have become integral elements of the classroom in Alaska schools. In Petersburg, over the past several years, the district has moved to stay ahead of the technology curve by providing students and staff with laptop computers, a better online connection, and a local support staff. Recently, several Petersburg high school teachers gave a presentation to the school board about how technology has changed the way they teach and the way their students learn. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Tooth in the itch gel lost 5.8% of its mass. The tooth in the Coca-Cola lost 0.5% of its
Students in Victor Troutman's science classes are using their laptop computers and other technology to create multimedia projects like this one. They combine their research experiments and reports with images and sound.
When you begin, or when I begin to compare a project that uses the technology that we have now to the one that was 30 years ago, you still do the same science, but it becomes a method of how you display it and convey real information versus just on a typewriter.
Troutman told the school board that in all of his classes, students use the internet to get their homework assignments and turn them in. It makes a big difference for local students who travel extensively for sports and other activities.
So part of this is just a delivery system of homework and collecting papers, because if they can get the paper, they can turn it in.
Parents can also go online to check on their child's progress and performance. Beyond the mechanics of homework and presentations, Troutman told the board that the internet provides access to the latest learning materials.
For example, with my anatomy and physiology, I have not ever even considered getting a textbook, because most textbooks are 3 to 4 years out of date by the time they're printed. And with anatomy is changing monthly. And so what this allows us to do is do some direct up-to-date research and reading.
Government history and videography teacher Jim Engel makes plenty of use of the computer's capabilities. For instance, Engel combines images, sounds, and text to help students study the progression of African-American civil rights.
They watched Martin Luther King's speech right here. It's on there. And then all embedded in there. And then they watch Barack Obama's victory speech, you know, and of course, you know, you got kids from all different political persuasions, and you don't try to, you try to keep it very objective and centered on the history of it.
One of the exercises Engel did this year was to have his students try to explain in simple language the basics of key historic documents like the U.S. Constitution.
And again, the whole goal is for them to put it in very simple terms.
Most people think that the Constitution is a bunch of big words written by some very old men. But the Constitution is something that is actually very important to all Americans.
One problem local students sometimes face when they travel to other schools is that the internet connections may not always be as fast or as accessible as in the Petersburg district. The school district began providing students and teachers with Apple laptop computers in 2006. In the middle and elementary schools, the units are kept in the classroom, while high schoolers receive their own personal laptops to use in and out of school from their freshman through their senior years. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Support for APRN comes from Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.